Have we finally worn you down on Derek Norris?
I think I've gotten to the point where I find him acceptable.
Good evening, and welcome to episode 45 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Chinella and Mauricio Rubio. How are you guys doing this first Monday of somewhat spring training?
You know, I am looking at baseball players in shorts and trying to really just go past whatever this March thing is right now, because it's not pleasant so far.
You're still in Chicago, Mao, or did you migrate yet?
No. We all migrate next Friday.
So. That's next Friday.
Okay. Yes.
So you have a few days.
I do, and it's supposed to be like terrible weather tomorrow with like sleet and slush and all that good stuff. So
that sucks.
Yeah. Give me a nice little kiss on the mouth, so it'll be all good.
it'll be real good. Yeah, I think as long as none of us sliced any body part open trying to get into a hot tub, I think life is pretty good.
Yeah. Was that Corey Hart?
That was definitely Corey Hart.
Or fracture a foot getting off a truck.
Yeah. I mean, Corey Hart's a big guy. I mean, it's hard to keep track of those limbs in a hot tub.
There are all sorts of hot tub time machine jokes that just want to be made right now.
that too. let's pleasantry away. You can read all of us at baseballperspectives.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mao is at MRubio52. And Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And I don't know why I switched the two of you that time. I'm usually very, very consistent with this. You can email us, flagsflyforever@baseballperspectives.com. And we ask that you rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher radio app or other things that you listen to podcasts on. So today we are going to do the final portion of our positional series addendum, I guess, via podcast. We're going to talk about relievers. Yay! So, but first we are going to answer an email and we are going to talk a little bit about Mike's experience in the first of the expert leagues this year in CBS. So let's get started with the email portion. We got this email from Rob. It says, "Hey guys, I'm in a 10-team standard keeper league where we keep players forever without penalty contracts or price increase. Roster wise, we keep 8 players, and you have to keep 2 pitchers every year. His last keeper spot is between David Ortiz and Javier Baez. Says, my thought is to go to keep Ortiz and go in early on Baez. Is this worth the risk of losing Baez? Or in this league format, is holding Baez worth the growing pains? Due to some trades last year to push for a championship, my team got old rather fast, so Baez is very enticing here. But it's pretty clear that absent of injury, David Ortiz is going to have a great year. Thanks, Rob." So this is a, you know, it's a rather benign question, but it's a good jumping off point to talk about sort of the keeper values of David Ortiz and Javier Baez. So let's kind of go in order. Mike, why don't you talk about David Ortiz and sort of where your comfort level is in keeping him in a league like this?
Well, I see a couple factors here. I mean, one factor is, you know, as great and consistent as David Ortiz is, you know, obviously he's older. It's a keep forever, which kind of makes it more interesting than, say, a straight-up roto where, you know, the clock is running on everybody. I think he's pretty solid. I mean, obviously you're going to get more out of Ortiz, you know, this year, or I would think so, than you're out of Baez, unless Baez hits like the upper end of his projection, particularly on the batting average. So those are kind of the factors I'd weigh. You know, the funny thing about this is, you know, our questioner Robert is like, you know, I kind of went for it last year. My team got old, but I look at his core, and I think an argument could be actually made for keeping Baez, because this core is pretty good. And I guess the follow-up question I'd have for Robert is, you know, what is the value of these guys in trade and season? Because that, to me, is a lot of what this question comes down to, I think, more so than what Ortiz in a league that's a 10-team league is going to produce.
All right. So now let's go to the other side of it. So, Mao, talk about Baez and his viability as a keeper in this sort of league.
So you're, you know, it's a 10 team and you're keeping eight, so the pool's going to be about 80. Baez's value is kind of there's high variance with where Baez is being taken in a lot of, you know, redraft leagues from what I'm seeing. So I think we talked about him a couple of podcasts ago back in the shortstop series, and you know, Mike, and you were pretty comfortable with taking him closer to like the 120 range instead of, you know, he was starting to creep up into like the top 100 range. And so this is different though because of the keeping forever factor. So there's going to be growing pains with Baez, and I think that's pretty clear, especially with what happened last year. But if you really believe in him and think that he can even reach a little bit of the potential that he's kind of teased at throughout his minor league career, I think the case can similarly be made for keeping him over David Ortiz. I don't think it's a big crime if you keep him, you know, within the as one of the top 80 players being kept in the league. I guess I kind of want to take this in a little bit of a different direction since we're talking about relievers anyway. Would you keep either of these guys or over Craig Kimbrel? Like, would you advocate for going Baez and Ortiz over Kimbrel?
I don't think he can. He has to keep two pitchers.
Oh, okay. Sorry. My bad. Well, that kind of shuts that out.
Sounds good. I you know, my opinion here is that you keep Ortiz. I like Baez, and I like Baez long term. But you know, in a league where, Matt, you kind of hit on it before, in a league where you keep 80 players and 80 players only, and two of them have to be pitchers, so you're talking about 60 players being kept every year. I don't believe he's going to be that guy for this year, and in a league with this few keepers, I think you skew really, really heavily towards 2015 value, even though you can keep these guys forever. So I'm curious, Mike, what's your closing thought here?
No, that's my same take. You know, I think you could consider Baez, but between the number of keeps and the shallowness of the league, I think you have to go with the proven commodity, particularly because the replacement level player, the guys like Baez who are the futures, there's going to be more out of them and more of them in the pool than in a deeper league. So yeah, I think in the end, you know, it's tough to let him go, and you know, if somebody takes him early, you might regret it. But I think you have to go Poppy in this format.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the same. I was really trying to set that up for the Kimbrel question, but you know, given the format, it's you got to keep Ortiz.
Sounds good. So let's go to the second question of the night. This one is from Brett. It says, Mike, you were in CBS NL last week. What's up?
I think that's actually a question from you, and you threw me off because we had a real question from a Brett, and I thought you were going to dive into that.
Way so, to make us all scramble for that question, Brett.
That was
confused.
Yeah, I'm.
And Brett, if you're listening, I'm sorry, but we're we're not going to address your question this week, and now I feel really bad.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to make Brett feel bad, but we're going to CBS.
Very quickly, please direct all of your hate to @DynastyGuru on Twitter.
Well, to be fair, when all hate is welcome there.
Yeah, Twitter is like a hateful place sometimes, man.
It is. That's
very existential.
Yeah. Anywho, so what do you want to know? I mean, I can tee it off a little bit. This is a CBS is a deep expert league. There's an AL only, which I did not participate in this year, and an NL only, which I did. It was a draft format going back to 2004. In 2008, they switched to auction, which they've been doing ever since. It's not quite as strong as Labor and Tout Wars, but it's kind of a good setup, and it does give you a pretty decent idea of what kind of prices you're going to see in Labor coming up this weekend. So I do like it for that reason. It's not a bad like kind of template or way to set expectations. And things happen in this auction. Like, you know, I set my prices and I put my first bids up for Baseball Prospectus last week, and things happen that I just get surprised by, and I kind of look and I'm like, okay, I need to fix some of these prices, because if I don't, there's some really weird things are going to happen.
Yeah, so I guess we'll kind of go a little deeper in here now. Let's talk about your team first. So what was your strategy going in, and how well did you stick to it?
Well, what I generally like to do, and the article I think will be out by the time this lands, because the article will be out on Tuesday, and you know, Mal will probably have this up on Tuesday or Wednesday. What I like to do in these early auctions is to try to go for balance. I don't really like to go stars and scrubs, because it's very dangerous. If you get an injury in spring training with one of your stars, it can really hurt you. If you have a lot of $1 players and they're backups or scrubs, and three or four of them don't work out, it kind of sinks you early, especially because there's a 7-man reserve in this league, which, as I mentioned, was an NL only. Once across the board, and you know, both on the hitting side, both on the pitching side, as you guys know, I'm not averse to throwing closer boards. So if that happened, I would have been fine with that. So really, that was the goal, just kind of a solid all around team that can, you know, kind of withstand a couple injuries or poor performances. And that's really what I go for. I just kind of go for that balance. There's nothing elegant to it. And something I try to take advantage of is people in CBS historically, there was a blip in a couple of years they didn't, but historically people overspend compared to Labor and Tout. So I kind of sit back and wait and try to make my move a little bit later.
Okay. So I'm looking at your team right now. I'm looking really at your outfield. Your outfield is very strong. And the guy who I think, if I know you well, the guy who I think you are very happy with at the price you got him for is Charlie Blackmon, who you got at $22. He's a guy that we drafted on our mixed labor team. What was your bet on Blackmon?
I think it was 24. I think if somebody said 23, I might have let him walk. So it wasn't like I had him as a big bargain, but he, you know, I think Al Melchior talked about this on the post show for CBS, and this is where I was. I don't think that's a big bargain necessarily. I think that's a fair price. And the thing about Blackmon is, if everyone's like, oh, he had a great April, oh, he can't hit, you know, he only hits against one side. But if you take out his April, he's a 15 home run, 20 steal guy last year with a 270 average. And if he does that in an NL only, he'll be worth this price.
Sounds good. I'm obviously I'm a believer in in the Ryan Braun comeback story. We talked about a little bit of this in Outfield Week. But the your outfield anchored by Braun, Blackman, and Ozuna, Marcell Ozuna, who I really like as well. It seems like a lot of the power production on your team is going to have to come from the outfield.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And Curtis Granderson too. I'm kind of hoping for 20 home runs from him. The rest of the team, and particularly the infield, which I'm sure we'll get to in a moment. The infield is kind of a group of the guys who are starters there, of which there are four of them. That's kind of a group of pluggers, guys that you just kind of hope play a full season, get enough runs and runs batted in, hit a few home runs, steal a few bases. But yeah, the outfield's where, and I think I spent over $100 on that outfield out of 175 on offense. That's where you would expect on a team like this most of the production to come from.
All right. Follow-up question. Have we finally worn you down on Derek Norris?
I think I've gotten to the point where I find him acceptable. Something weird that happened in this auction. Well, there are a couple things. We'll get this to the infield. With the catchers, usually you see a point where people chase catchers and chase catchers and chase catchers. In this auction, people really laid off. So I got Norris for 10, which I thought was fine. I think my sheet price on him was 12. I got Yadier Molina at 14. Now, I am not even a big Molina believer this year. I'm a little skeptical. But it seems to me that all he has to do is play 130 games. And even if he doesn't bounce all the way back to his 2013-2012 production, he should earn that easily. I was really surprised that people laid off at catchers. Usually, there's a scarcity tax in CBS, and we didn't see that this year.
All right. The next place I want to go here is something that we've talked about on the podcast before. We actually talked about a bit on the episode where we were joined by Peter Kreutzer. You guys sort of bemoaned the third base situation in the National League. So talk about the two third basemen that you have and sort of how this happened. I'll let you take it from there. You can say who these guys are.
Sure. I don't think this is as bad as that intro makes it sound. So I got Cody Ash at 10, which is pretty much par, and I got Mike Alt at a buck. Now, Ash was a guy who – well, a couple things happened. For one, and this happened more at first base than third base, the corner prices just kind of sailed through the roof. Now, first base sailed through the roof because – as we talked about earlier, there's a couple guys starting who aren't eligible yet in Ryan Zimmerman and Pedro Alvarez. So it's pretty limited. There aren't as many starters as you'd expect. And you got a guy or two. Yonder Alonso is the guy who jumps out. But you got a guy or two at the position that are kind of eh and not the most exciting players there either. So I pretty much blew off the position, which I know is a weird thing. But because I got the two starting catchers, I stuck Alberto Chiaspo, who's eligible at first, in there for a buck. And in El Oli, my thinking is I hope he wins the job. If he doesn't, they're talking about him being a utility guy. He'll earn that buck. He might be a $5 or $6 player, but he's my last player, or maybe Alt's my last player in an NL only. What happened with third base, there were a few things. Pedro Alvarez was a guy, I think he went for 15 to Al Melchior of CBS. I tried to hit 16 on the button. I was kind of wavering. This was an online auction, and by the time I hit it, it said he was gone. So that was one situation where that happened. But really, a lot of what happened, it wasn't computer glitches. It wasn't anything else. There were just a lot of players that were kind of either going for par or above par. And, in retrospect, there's a couple guys that I'd probably rather have than Ashy, but again, they're all at prices that were kind of close to what I had them at. It wasn't like there was a bargain later. I was like, oh no, I wish I got him. So, I think Ashy will be okay. I don't think he'll. I think Franco will be up at some point, but I really have a suspicion that it's more likely that Ryan Howard gets cut or gets his playing time diminished. And I'm not saying Franco is going to move to first. I think it's going to be more kind of a job share. So I kind of look at him and I just shrug. I'm like, he's okay. He is what he is. he should earn that or in that vicinity. Again, it's not the most exciting thing, but this kind of goes back to what I've talked about before with value, which is I don't mind packing one area of the team with value, you know, like I did in the outfield, and just kind of hoping to get some par or slightly above par performances elsewhere.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing about Ashi, I mean, he's certainly not a sexy pick, but he's also, from what I've seen, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's going to get some reps in left field as well. So it opens up additional path to playing time should, you know, Franco get called up. And, I mean, the Phillies have nobody in the outfield. It's just...
Grady Sizemore is one of their starters.
Yeah, that pretty much says it all.
He's not going to live.
And I hope he does, but he probably won't.
He's the better of their corner outfield starters. Oh. That's the sad part.
I know. Well, I think that's part of it. And, you know, the funny thing about, you know, Ashi is that he's not a great player, but you hit the nail on the head, Brett. Like, given the Phillies and given his age, I think they'd probably like to see for the next year or two what he is. So regardless of where he plays, I think you're right. I think he'll play somewhere. I don't think it's a situation where if he's hitting, you know, if he's hitting like 260, 270 with moderate or, you know, a little bit below moderate power, I don't think they're going to cut him. I think they're going to try to see if they can, you know, make it work. You know, as we know, the next Phillies contending team conservatively is in 2017, and that might be generous. So, yeah, Ashley's 25 years old. He could be a part of that team. Grady Sizemore will be 33 at some point this year. He won't. You know, Ryan Howard, 35. He won't. I think you'll see him play one of those positions at some point.
Yeah. Just looking at the list of third basemen, I have to ask. All the values make sense to me scrolling down the list until I get to Aramis Ramirez at $13. I know there's risk there, but that struck me as really the only guy at the position that seemed like a bit of a bargain. Was that one of the guys you were thinking of?
Or? Yeah, he's probably the guy that I should have said 14 on, given what happened later. I think 14 was my sheet price on him. I'm a little down on him this year. I'm not really as high on him as I think you are and some of the other BP staffers are. But even so, I you know, if you told me going back in time, would you rather have Ramirez at 14 or Ashi at 10? I'd rather have Ramirez.
Fair enough. So, I guess we'll cover one or two more guys before we move on to your pitching staff. The one buy that I really, really liked, there were a number of them, but one that I especially liked was Brandon Phillips at $10. Obviously, 2014 was not kind to Phillips for a number of reasons, but he still remains a very good bet to play a lot of games and rack up stuff everywhere, even if it's not nearly what he used to rack up. Was he sort of one of your better buys, or were you just kind of meh about that one?
Well, at the time, I thought he was okay, you know, and you're right about him. You know, in a down year last year, in less than a full season, he earned 11 in NL only. So he could certainly – and I always like guys – and he's on the older side of the curve, but I always like guys that have the down year and were bid up higher and bidding somewhere in the middle. And I kind of did the same thing with Andrelton Simmons, who I got at shortstop for 10. You know, Phillips' average bid last year was 18. You know, sure, I got him for 10. You figure he can earn 14, and he's a bit of a bargain. The only problem was, you know, just as the corners kind of went for a lot of money, there were a lot of middle infielders that just snuck through cheap, a little cheap, or maybe more than a little cheap at the end. Like as an example, I'd like Phillips, but I'd rather have Chase Utley. You know, he went for 12. You know, I'd rather have Chase Utley at 13. Aaron Hill, who I know you like, Brett, went for 7. I'd rather have him for 8. What had happened, though, is I think I bought Braun and Blackman I bought Braun in the third round. He's my first player, and I kind of sat back for a little while after getting Braun and Blackman. And you know it is in these auctions. Like, you're sitting there, and you're like, you know, I got to spend my money. I can't just sit back forever and wait for the perfect price. And I thought Phillips and Simmons were both fine. It's just, had I known, you know, later that those so many middle infielders were going to fall through, I definitely would have, you know, spent a little bit more in a corner and just waited for some of those bargains.
Fair enough. Random question. Was Jorge Soler really the first player thrown out in CBS?
He was. Although I think what happened was, I think whoever that was, the timer ran out. And Scott White, who was running the auction room, asked if I'm trying to remember who the representative was who threw him out, but he asked if he wanted to take it back, and he's like, "No," he's like, "Forget it, like just let it go." So that was some of that. I threw out Ryan Howard. I had the third call. I threw Ryan Howard out just to see what would happen.
Well, you're just a jerk, Mike. Like that's
pretty well. Cool. I was hoping to either get him at like freeze the room and get him at like 3 or 4, or you know, help you one for like 12.
Yeah.
So it didn't really work. He went for 9.
Yeah, that's somewhere in the middle. But so let's talk a little bit about your pitching staff, and then we'll wrap with some closing thoughts. You did not avoid saves. Really at all, with three guys who could potentially get saves this year. Talk about the $24 that you spent on closers and sort of how that materialized.
Well, Jonathan Papelbon was my first pitcher that I got, and he went for 14, and I think that's a good price. I think some people are shying away from him because they're afraid of the trade. Now, CBS, unlike Labor and Tout, if he gets traded or any player gets traded to the American League, you just lose him. Like, that's kind of an old school rule. Oof. That CBS has. Yeah, so that's the risk with Papelbon. But my thinking is, you know, and you talked about this, I think, offline with the Brewers. I think the Toronto rumors are similar. I think Papelbon would love to go anywhere at this point that isn't the Phillies, that he could get saves. But I don't think the Blue Jays are going to trade anything of value for him, you know, given the fact that the Phillies aren't just going to eat the entire contract. So there's a bit of a stalemate with I think, the Phillies and other teams. And we see this with Hamels, too. And I think the Phillies' attitude is, well, if we don't get someone halfway decent back, why should we eat any money? And that vesting option is also killer. You know, I don't think Papelbon is just going to give that up or say, well, okay, I'll take the trade and, you know, see what happens on the market in 2016. He's not going to get $13 million in 2016. So I think there's a good possibility that he stays with the Phillies at least up until the trade deadline or close to it. Or even longer. I don't necessarily see an imperative for a team, like I said, to say, we're just going to make that deal. So at a minimum, if I get 3 months, 3.5 months out of Papelbon, I think he earns that.
Sounds good. So let's talk about the two sort of younger high upside guys that you purchased in the rotation, Zach Wheeler and Shelby Miller. What are your realistic expectations for the two of them this year? And do you think they end up as your two best pitchers?
Well, to answer this backwards, I would say probably not. I'd be really happy if one of them took a step forward and was one of my two best pitchers, just because I've got Doug Fister and Matt Latos in front of them. And realistically, I would hope that they would be 1-2 in terms of what they can produce. You know, Latos last year pitched, what was like 102 innings or close to that, and still earned like $8 or $9. And Fister, I know, because I looked at this and Keith Cromer talked about this in his NL article, Fister earned 21. And, you know, I know some of that, you know, low strikeouts and ERA is variable, but Fister does this almost every year with the ground balls. So I doubt that both those guys will be my top two. I do think Wheeler, you know, Wheeler's a guy who's just intriguing. And, you know, I know, Brett, you've watched him being in New York, and I've watched him as a Mets fan. He's just one of those players you watch and you're like, you know, he's so close to emerging it as that, you know, I don't want to say an ace, but he's so close to emerging as that like number two guy. His stuff is so good. He could strike out 200. That's not really hard to envision with him. I think some of it is just getting that consistency together. Miller's a little bit more difficult to envision just because he's a project, and you know, he's certainly got a good guy in Roger McDowell to work with. And it's just hard to say. I think there's a lot of outcomes for Miller. You know, I think one of them is he comes fairly close to what he did in St. Louis. You know, I think another outcome is more of last year where you just kind of look at him at the end and you're like, eh. You know, and if he's the option, I think I'll be disappointed. I'm kind of hoping it comes out somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, obviously Atlanta's going to be tricky for wins this year, but I think from a pure performance standpoint, I really like Miller at that price. So any closing thoughts? What are you who are the one or two guys you got on reserve for you are most excited about?
I don't think I'm excited about any of these guys. This was a very practical reserve list because my corners were bad. I took four corners, and I kind of you in mind too, Brett, because you know you always talk about platooning guys. So I took two players in Tommy Bodica and Luis Jimenez, who I figure if the Brewers or Padres are facing a lefty, you know, heavy staff, I'll throw them in for Chiospo, you know, and just the hopes to get some power. I do, you know, we didn't mention, you mentioned the closers. I took LaTroy Hawkins and Bobby Parnell for five apiece. I did take Adam Ottavino on reserve because I really think, I know Axford's in camp, but I really think Ottavino could be the guy this year who steps up and gets the saves if Hawkins can't do it.
Sounds good. Did Jairo Diaz go in reserve?
I don't think he did. No.
No.
I'm gonna look, but
I don't know. I just found the reserves, but I didn't see it. Jumbo Diaz did.
He did. Just
wow.
A
wow. Jumbo a quick... Diaz over Jairo Diaz. That's. Yeah. That's
wrong
cold.
Diaz.
That is definitely Diaz. The wrong Diaz.
I agree. Just although I think by the time we get to the end of these things, everybody's really fatigued. It's like a 4-hour online auction, and then it's like a boom, boom on the reserve. I think everybody just wants to leave. Just a quick note. We can't talk about everyone's team, but there was the FanDuel entry spent, I'm trying to do that, $80 combined on Billy Hamilton at 29, Dee Gordon at 27, and Ben Revere at 24. I had to point that out. And if you're wondering what the rest of his team looks like, it's kind of a Stars and Scrubs team. He's got some guys on offense. He's got Lucas Duda, who, as you know, I like this year at 21. He's got Ian Desmond at 28. He just doesn't have enough. And it's not like the guys he picked up on the cheap are particularly great. I think Johnny Gomes at a buck could be decent. Alexi Amarista at three could earn his, you know, more than earn his keep. He also bought Kershaw at 43. You know, basically he's got Kershaw, McCarthy, Benoit, and a bunch of prayers. So it's a Stars and Scrubs team that I don't think quite has enough appeal to overcome that. And the one other thing about CBS is there's rarely any trading, because I shared this on Twitter and somebody's like, oh, like, well, he can trade. It's like, well, you know, first of all, if you're going to go that route, I think you take two guys like that. You don't take three. But it's a league that doesn't trade. So it's going to be really hard for – you know, for who this was to kind of bounce back. I just thought it was something worth pointing out. It's a pretty funky thing you don't see very often.
Now, is this that guy's first year in the league?
I do not think so.
Okay. Because that's an important point to hit on, that, you know, if you're in a league that you haven't been in before, or you're not all that, you don't have that sort of comfort level with how the league operates, never assume that you're going to be able to trade for what you want to trade for. That's something that you do as you get more comfortable with your league and playing in, you know, multiple years.
Well, and expert leagues, you know, Tout Wars, which has more trading than CBS, I think it took me 3 years or maybe even 4 years to get to a comfortable level with trading, you know, because you're when you are a rookie, particularly in expert league, you're right. People just look at you like, haha, I'm going to rip this guy off.
Yeah.
So, one thing I will say to that point, though, is that CBS compared to Labor and Tout, people often ask me what the difference is. Labor and Tout, top to bottom, the experts are all like super solid. I think what happens in CBS is that half the experts are really good and really solid, and then you have another half. They know baseball. They certainly know fantasy, but they're more mixed league guys. That you can tell when you get to the end. They don't know auctions, so they tend to just kind of you know, by the big guys or Ghost Stars and Scrubs, or they get to the end, and that's why you see some of these picks where you look and you're like, yeah, these guys are really stumbling here just to find people that can fill their rosters up. Like there's someone in the American League like that who is really like kind of weak in the end game, and it's just obvious that, you know, that these guys are mixed league guys.
Yeah, you can also tell those guys because some of them take prospects in the reserve round that are extremely unlikely to see the majors. It's pretty. I mean,
you see some of that in labor and tau, but I know what you're saying. Like you definitely see these guys get taken. Yeah, that they're an A ball or their names on the Baseball America Top 100, and it's like, well, you know, or you see someone, I don't think he was taken, you know, in CBS. You see someone like Austin Hedges who's taken, and you're like, well, even if he somehow makes it up, he just has no fantasy value, and you're just grasping for a name.
Yeah, and I want to shake the hand of the person that took Junior Lake at the end of the reserve round.
There were some. I don't think
Thanks,
so.
Mel.
I just figured out the joke there. You have to like play some. You have to. We have to steal from Tino. We have to play some Enya here now.
I love someone taking. I don't even know who this is, and I don't mean this in any sort of negative way. I love the fact that someone took Lucas Giolito in the reserve round of this draft. Not because I particularly care about how this pick turns out, but just because that's how freaking exciting Lucas Giolito is. He hasn't pitched above A ball, and he's getting drafted in a redraft league.
Although it was a seventh round pick too in the reserve. So
still.
I know what you're saying. Well, you know, it's funny because this guy's, you know, I look at this guy, he took, you know, a lot of guys that might or might not be up this year in his reserve, which, you know, the funny thing about this is the moves are so liberal in terms of replacing guys on reserve. It almost doesn't matter what your reserves look like right now. You could pretty much in March just – it's daily moves. It's weekly lineup at daily moves. You could pretty much just churn guys constantly until you find somebody that you like. And that's what I usually do. When I first joined the league, Eric Mack, who's no longer with CBS, he was like the master at that. You'd go look, you'd be like, oh, I want to pick up this guy who's been hot in like, you know, AAA for 2 weeks. You'd look, he's like, he's gone. What? And he was on Eric's team. It never failed. Like I learned that you pretty much have to be super aggressive in this league if you want to get those guys.
Yeah. So obviously best of luck to Mike in this league. And, to Keith Cromer as well, another member of our BP team who is competing in both the AL and the NL.
Yeah, we'll have to take him to Kangaroo Court for not showing up for this little talk.
That is very true. He's off somewhere, probably wearing a Martin Maldonado jersey.
That's a very specific jersey.
It is. So with that, Mal, you're the master of this. Should we take a break or should we go straight into relievers?
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back.
You heard the man. We'll be right back. Welcome back to episode 45 of Flags Fly Forever. We are still a baseball prospectus, baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. Now we're going to talk about relief pitchers, and we're going to do it as long as we can before we all decide to just quit. So we're going to start at the top, but we're not really going to expand on the top. The five-star group is super obvious to just about anyone. It's Aroldis Chapman, Craig Kimball, and Greg Holland. They're all really good. Just only one question about this. Would Kenley Jansen have been in this group had he not hurt his ouchie?
Yes.
Yep.
He would have. He was there for me, and I think after the injury, I pushed him down.
Makes sense to me. I would agree with that.
So, I will say before you move on about Jansen, I agree with Craig Goldstein's point today in the target piece that, you know, he's being discounted and by some, I think, a little bit too much. He's still near the top of the, and we'll get to this, but he's still in the top of the four star.
Yeah, he's how much time is he scheduled to miss, right? He's
8 to 12 weeks, I think.
Well, 8 to 12 from the time of the injury.
Yeah, so we're talking about May, I believe.
Yeah. So we're talking about Aroldis Chapman timing from 2014, give or take. So that was the second week of May.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that seems reasonable. So the four-star tier is thick and filled with lots of guys who you could order in a lot of different directions. But I really want to talk about the guy who leads the four-star tier, and that's the crown jewel of our labor pitching staff from 2014, and that is Dellin Betances. If you had to, there's a fun game that we've played on Tino Podcast, which I think is really a really good one here. If you had 100 shares of anything, 100 shares of sand, and you were splitting them between Dellin Betances and Andrew Miller as to who gets the percentage of saves over the course of the season, how much would you give to Betances?
I would say 90. I think that there's a few things at work. I know some people are saying that Joe Girardi is a more enlightened manager than most, and you know he might split the saves and he might, you know, play with matchups. But very few managers, unless they have nothing but weak options, will do that. They usually pick a guy. And when you have a Dellin Betances with his kind of stuff in the pen, I think Betances is the guy he's going to pick. It just Andrew Miller was solid last year, but I just don't think the two compare in terms of their stuff. And I think Miller's going to be a fine addition to the pen. You know, I think the other side of this, I think on some teams, if you made a financial investment in Andrew Miller, it would be the default of like, well, he's a closer. I know Betances is really good, but the guy we just gave, you know, $9 million a year to for 4 years is a closer. I don't think the Yankees have that consideration. I don't think it matters. So I'd really be skeptical. You know, the reason Betances isn't the four-star is because he might not close or there might be some kind of split on the saves. I just don't see a situation where Betances, if there's, you know, 40 saves in that bullpen, I don't see a situation where he doesn't get more than, like, you know, 32 or 33. So maybe my 90-10 split isn't quite right, but it's close.
I'd probably give it like 70 shares of sand, just for the reasons that Mike outlined pretty well. But you know, I think he's pretty undeniable, and I mean, you know, it's solid bullpen, but like that dude can be really special, especially in the ninth inning. So I'd probably go 70.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. Just one little thing on each point. The great point about Andrew Miller and the money. It would be a big deal for a lot of other teams, but the Yankees are the team that signed Rafael Soriano to a 3-year, $35 million contract to be their setup guy. So they're not afraid to throw money around in non-closer relief spots. So I don't think that's much of a concern. And the other point really hits it right on the head. You have, you know, it's sort of a saving mechanism, right? You have a team, say you have a team like the Tigers, bullpen like that. You have Joe Nathan in the role, supposedly, and let's assume for a second they had a half-decent lefty reliever. If you use that lefty reliever to get the last two outs of a game, no one is going to fault you for turning away from Joe Nathan, the guy who super sucks, in order to try to get those outs with a lefty. If you take the ball out of Devin Betances' hands to give them to someone else to get the platoon advantage, even someone who's as good as Andrew Miller, that is a very, very easy way to get second-guessed, and managers hate getting second-guessed. So that's why I really don't think that's much of a concern for Betances for the current year. But let's move on to a little bit further down to some more interesting names, because they make some people a little bit nervous. I'm gonna go through about five names, and we're going to rate them on the preseason panic meter for closers. So 10 being the safest of the safe, and 1 being, oh my God, is this Joe Nathan? Let's start with Trevor Rosenthal. Mike, where's Rosenthal for you on the preseason panic meter?
And what's the order here? Which direction?
10 is super safe. 1 is oh my God.
I'm probably more down on Rosenthal than some. I'd say he's like a 6. He's probably fine, but the walk rate, the way it crept up, you know, I always. The two things I look about relievers, and back when I was blessed to write the closer report in 2013, you know, I think I always made this point, which is if a reliever's giving up a bunch of hits but is keeping the ball in the park, it might give the manager agita, but there's sometimes that – unless he's extremely hittable, it's like, well, you know, that can be bad luck. It could be just balls not bouncing the pitcher's way. The two things that will get you out of the role so fast are walks and home runs. Because home runs are something that it's just a sign that the pitcher's got nothing. And walks, it's the whole idea. It's very difficult to walk, you know, 5 batters per 9 or even 4.5 per 9. You're just living in the danger zone. So I think Rosenthal should fix that. But it's easy for me to say that right now. I think if he has some trouble with his command early, I could see him flip. I could see the Cardinals flipping. The other thing is the Cardinals in the past have shown no reluctance to change, you know, roles and pull people out of there if it's not working out. So I'd say a 6, but of the guys on the 4-star, he's probably one of the more risky ones, in my opinion.
All right. Mao, do you have anything substantially different to add there?
No. No, I mean, I put him at a 5, but it's like kind of hedging the bet. So I still like him, but there's a ton of risk there.
All right, so let's go to the next name under him, and that is Zach Britton. I think we can all agree that Britton is a guy with a little less upside than Rosenthal, but do we think he's safer, Mal?
I think he's safer than Rosenthal, which is a pretty sharp 180 from where I was last year, and I know you gave me a lot of crap for this, but this is a guy that I just did not want to believe in, you know, even when he was doing this, you know, well into the season, and, you know, posting like a sub-2 ERA pretty deep into August, so like even then I was still kind of like, I don't really know how long this is going to last, but you know, just kind of reviewing the numbers and, you know, what he did last year, I'm putting him at a 7, maybe creeping him up to an 8. Just, you know, there's still a little bit of doubt, just given the past performance of what his strikeout rates have done, and just, you know, the player's profile overall. But he went out and he had a really solid, really great year last year, really. And, you know, he's earned a lot of leeway with me. And I know this is your boy, Brett. I know this is your boy.
He is. Mike, any substantial difference in your answer?
No, he's an 8 for me. I think he's, you know, pretty safe. Again, you know, the closers are not safe, but he looked okay. If anything would concern me, he tailed off a little bit, you know, 5 strikeouts in 10 innings down the stretch in September, but he could have just been fatigued. You know, I don't think that will carry over into 2015. He should be fine.
I agree. I love me some Zach Britton. But speaking of guys who I love, let's go to the next guy on the list. Mike, where are you on the preseason panic meter for Cody Allen?
I wouldn't panic about him at all. He's probably a 9. I really like Allen. I think he's really solid. I don't think I'm quite as high on him as you are, Brett, but I think his performance last year was legitimate.
Mal?
Yeah, you know, the thing about Allen is that he's kind of like a really warm blanket that you just kind of want to take with you whenever you feel scared. So, probably a 10.
I get that. I think Allen is absolutely the guy of this tier that I want, at least where he's going. I think he's an excellent reliever. He's not going to put up the super gaudy strikeout numbers of the high end guys, but he's just going to be really solid. And I think the Indians should afford him plenty of save opportunities. So I'm a fan. Let's do one more name, but we'll jump down. We'll skip some skip a guy here. How confident are you in Koji Uehara, Mal?
Not terribly. I want to be more confident, but he's pretty advanced in terms of age. He had a pretty scary year last year where, you know, things just kind of started creeping up for him. I know his final line looks pretty good. You know, he ended up with a .91 whip. He still held the peripheral together pretty well. So I mean, I have more confidence in Koji than I do in Trevor Rosenthal, certainly. So I guess I'd probably go with a 6 there. Which is, so yeah, I think I'll go with 6.
Okay, should I assume that that most of the risk you're worried about with Uehara is injury risk and not performance risk?
Right, sorry, it's yeah. Risk. Yeah, sorry.
Okay, risk all the same, but Mike, what about you? Anything majoritively different?
Similar, the one thing I'd add is I think if I was going to put – it's probably a 9 in the early going where I'd be pretty confident, but a 5 if you're talking about the full year. He kind of faded down the stretch, and to me that's where the age concern lies. It's just I don't know if he's going to hold up for a whole season at his age, and I know also the Red Sox have already talked about mixing and matching more and kind of giving him a little more rest. So a best case scenario, you might be looking at the Uehara 2013 rate stats, which are excellent, but fewer saves, which in a shallow mix or a standard mix, you kind of, that's kind of bad news. You really do want to get your saves out of your closers, particularly in that format.
All right. Let's jump down to the 3-star group. Let's take this question negative because it's closers. Who of this group, which is K-Rod, Hector Rondon, Addison Reed, and Neftali Feliz, who's the first guy of this tier to lose their job? Mike.
Well, you know, it's tough because he has the contract, but K-Rod's the guy I just really don't trust. His numbers looked great last year, but his FIP, I think, was a 4.47. And if you dive into the Brooks baseball numbers, and I think I mentioned this in the tier piece that I wrote, he pretty much was getting guys out with his changeup, and I think his fastball curve, the ISO on those was like both around 250. I don't have it in front of me. So he was just getting pounded, and I think he was really lucky that the overall numbers weren't worse. So, you know, it's just kind of that weird thing. He's been pitching a long time, a lot of mileage on that arm. He wasn't expensive, so it's not like the Brewers, like, are going to get killed on this. And I think that's some of the equation, too. Even though he got the contract, you've got Jonathan Broxton behind him, and you've got some other arms behind him in that pen, you know, like Jim Henderson, who I still think could reemerge. I wouldn't be surprised to see K-Rod, you know, kind of lay an egg and lose the job.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. I think it was, I'm sure this was JP, but JP Breen of Baseball Prospectus. But if you take out K-Rod's April when he was just ridiculous. He had a 3.98 ERA the rest of the way, and gave up 14 home runs in 52 innings. That's probably about what K-Rod is going to do. It may be good enough to hold the job for a while, maybe even the whole year, maybe even 2 years. But he's going to give up home runs, and he's certainly a risk there. Matt, what about you? Do you think K-Rod is that guy, or you got somebody else in mind?
I do think K-Rod's that guy, but I'm going to make the case for somebody else. I think there can be an interesting case for made for Hector Rondon just because of all the power arms behind him, and he could be walking the tightrope really early in the season. But I'm going to go with Addison Reed out in Arizona. You know, he's a very talented pitcher, and he's always shown the stuff, you know, to have, like, bat-missing stuff, and, you know, just has one of those profiles that you really want in a high-leverage late-inning reliever. But he hasn't really been able to avoid the home run ball, which is that's not good, as Mike was talking about a little bit earlier. And you know, in a ballpark like you know, where the Diamondbacks play, it's just not, it doesn't seem to be a good recipe for success. Now the Diamondbacks don't necessarily have a lot of good options behind them. They have Brad Ziegler, who I keep forgetting is still alive, and it's just not a very good bullpen behind him, but. I don't think that Reed has ever really put it together for a full season, and I can't really envision him doing it now. So, go with Reed.
Fair enough. For what it's worth, I sadly would go with Addison Reed. I really, really like Reed from a raw talent perspective, but I'm a little concerned there, and. Yeah, I mean, I think the other guys are reasonably solid. So let's keep going down. Let's compare and contrast the two injured lefty closers, Jake McGee and Sean Doolittle. Mike, you have McGee just a touch ahead of Doolittle, but is it more or less a coin flip at this point with two guys with relatively similar skill sets that with both with injuries that could be considered alarming.
Yeah, I was going to use that word before you did. I think it's and some of the reason they're here is that we just don't know. Doolittle in particular could be the guy who comes back, and if he's healthy, if he's 100%, I think Doolittle's better than McGee. But the injury with Doolittle concerns me a little bit more, which is why I have him right behind him. But that's just the risk. And, you know, in particularly in mono formats, I'd be really careful with these guys. You know, if you put, you know, too much of an investment on one of them and you get nothing, I think that's obviously just a big loss.
Yeah, it's certainly a risky scenario for both, which is a shame because it's a really good situation for both, and they both could be. I mean, I guess I'll throw this back at you. If they were both perfectly healthy, would they both be top end of the 4-star tier?
At least Doolittle would be closer to the top. I think McGee would be. I want to say the middle, probably the low end of the top. I guess. They could be, though. You know, they both were really, if you look at the peripherals and you take out the saves, they were both top 10 relievers last year easily. So it's certainly possible.
All right. So we're going to play one little fun game with some of these guys in the 2-star tier before we move down. The last four guys in this tier. All are going to face competition either from pitchers who are good or competition from pitchers who are there because they are terrible. So we're going to do some over-unders here. Luke Gregerson, over-under on 19.5 saves. Mike?
I'd say over, but barely.
Mal?
I'm going to go over pretty fairly, but it's going to be close.
I'm going to go under. I think there's a lot of competition there, and I don't, I, I don't, I'm not super confident in him. Next guy down the list, Bobby Parnell. Over under 16.5 saves. Mal.
I'm going to go under.
Mike?
I'm going to go over because it's the Mets, and even though if Mejia pitches well early on, he should hold the job. It's the Mets, so they're probably going to try to stick Parnell in there anyway.
I'm going to go under, but very barely. I think you're absolutely right. I think the Mets will try to stick him back there, but I don't think he'll be both good and healthy at the same time this year. I have my questions whether he'll what his performance level will be. LaTroy Hawkins, over under 14.5 saves. Mike.
I think over, but again, not by much.
Mal?
Yeah, he's going to be under 20, but I think he's going to be over 14.5.
I'm going to go over as well. And finally, everyone's punching bag, Joe Nathan, over under 14.5 saves. Mal?
Yeah, I know in that bullpen, he might not get to 10. I'm going under on that.
Yeah, I'm going under. I have a... He might not make it out of spring training, so
this is like the feel good Joe Nathan podcast.
You said punchy bag, I just wound up and like
yeah. Everyone polish off your shotguns. All right, so now it's time to now it's time to play everyone's favorite game. It's the final time we're going to play it this year. Hope everyone has some good selections. We are going to start this week with Mike. Who's your one-star guy here?
Oh, so many wonderful choices. Where to even begin? This is me, like, stalling. I'm actually, for all I said about Papelbon in the CBS segment, I'm going to go with Ken Giles because I think that no, whether he's the closer at some point, whether he isn't the closer, I see him returning. The wins might not be there, or the garbage wins because it's the Phillies, but I see him returning a lot of value regardless of the role. So I'm going to go with Giles.
Mal?
I'm gonna go with Neil Ramirez, actually. I do like Hector Rondon, but I think he's a strong arm in that bullpen. And if Rondon does show any signs of struggle, I think Ramirez is a logical solution to go to as the next in line for the closer. And he's a pretty nasty dude. So I think Ramirez is, getting groomed for it, and I think he's ready.
Sounds good. I am going to sort of piggyback off of my my point about Bobby Parnell before, and I'm going to take Henry Mejia here. I just think that, despite what Terry Collins might want to do with Parnell, I think Mejia is going to be his best option. I at some point, I just don't think he's going to have much choice rather than to leave Mejia in the role. I think he's the best bet of this group to get to 20 saves. I think there's a fairly good chance that he'll get there. One final question, though, digging even deeper than the one-star group, into the negative one-star group. More saves in 2015, the closer zombie version, Jason Mott or Ernesto Friere?
Jesus. I'm going to go with Kevin Gregg. Hell, if we're going to go all zombie about it.
Where's Heath Bell these days?
I don't know.
Is he on the Nationals? I feel like he's on the Nationals.
He seems like he's on the Nationals, doesn't he?
He's probably not on the Nationals.
This conversation was like sad already. It's just really getting sad.
It's getting sad, but there is a pretty decent shot that either Mott or Friere gets 10 saves this year. And I have no idea who it's going to be because they are the capital F, capital C former closer.
Yeah, they are.
That's possible.
I guess I'll put the ledger on Fieri, but that's like there's no confidence behind that. None.
No, nor should they be. Nor should there be. That's actually proper English.
There you go.
And yes, Heath Bell is a member of the Washington Nationals.
Wow, look at you.
Good. Very good. Very, very good.
If it looks like a National, it smells like a National. It's probably maybe, Heath Bell.
Maybe he'll get a ring.
Maybe.
I don't know if I'm ready for that.
Did you know that Heath Bell had half of his career WAR in 2007?
You know, this is what happens with relievers, though. I mean, you dig deep enough and you just come up with really sad facts about former relievers.
That's true. He's been worth negative 1.4 wins over the last 3 years. That's hard for a reliever to do.
I know. You have to like actually actively try to be that bad.
Yeah, he was worth negative 0.6 wins last year in 17 innings and got paid $9 million for it.
Oh my god, this is going to make me cry. This is going
That is the American dream.
Oh. Good god.
Three-time All-Star Heath Bell.
I remember when he signed that contract with the Marlins. Oh man.
Was it always the Marlins?
They were giving out money because every few years they give out a ton of money and then they trade everybody away.
You notice that the Marlins have the saddest relievers who just last forever, though? Like, it's always the Marlin.
Yeah. That it is. All right, so I think the world has had enough reliever talk.
Who's doing the closer report this year?
Not me.
We're gonna put Keith and Matt in a steel cage and make them fight for it.
I could do the minor league closer report if you want that. It'd be real interesting.
Yeah,
that was fun today. There was a comment thread where it's like, you know, somebody asked about the minor league prospect relievers, and we're all like, no, don't even bother.
Yeah, can you say Kevin Quackenbush five times fast?
Yeah, but no.
No, I didn't think so. All right. So we are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back to close things up. We are back. Thank you for listening to episode 45 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a Baseball Prospectus fantasy podcast. You have been listening to myself, Brett Sayer, Mike Janella, and Mal is Mauricio Rubio. You can find all of us at baseballprospectus.com, where you can go today and subscribe and get a premium membership and get all of our wonderful fantasy content as we approach your drafts. All of the fun content we have planned for the season also includes all of our prospect and our general baseball content, which is quite excellent. If you sign up for a super premium membership, you get access to the Bat Signal, where you can ask us all kinds of questions about your fantasy team. With that, you can always reach us, flagsflyforeverbaseballprospectus.com. If you have emails that you want us to read on the show or suggestions for topics, we again are going to do that more and more as we continue through the season. And that is it. Next week we will be back with our non-season preview format, which means we will be doing whatever we want to do, and you guys don't have a choice. We're probably going to be talking about the labor drafts, so not that that should surprise anyone. But have a good week, and we will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Toodles.
We made it.
Yeah. not just the relievers, but this whole series, which I think when we start with catchers, we're all excited, and by the time we get to relievers, we're all